Hello, everyone. I'm Jamie Smith. My partner Lee Connor and I would like to thank all of you for coming, and we'd like to welcome you to Connor Contemporary Art. We're pleased to present David Leventhal's exhibition, War, in conjunction with Photo Week DC. We're especially pleased to host this discussion with the artist, which as you can see, is being recorded and will be podcast later. David, as many of you know, is a founder of the fabrication movement in photography. His photographs are in permanent collections at the National Gallery of Art, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the Whitney, to mention only a few of the prestigious institutions that own his works. During his three-decade career, David has become famous for his artistic examination of the socializing power of dolls, toys, and other human surrogates. He has addressed racial and gender stereotypes in compelling works on the Holocaust, pornography, black memorabilia, and the Western frontier, all of which we've had the pleasure of exhibiting through the past several years. And now we are honored to exhibit the series that started it all, Hitler Moves East. It's especially exciting that in juxtaposition with this legendary work from 1975, David is also presenting his latest series of photographs representing the U.S. invasion of Iraq. We're thrilled to have the artist here to give us his personal insights on these two bodies of work and discuss the meaningful interrelationships between them. So please join me in welcoming Mr. David Leventhal.
You know, when you said three decades of work, I'm glad I get to sit down while I'm giving this talk. There was some other reference to my age in there too, but I can't remember what it was. Just probably an also sign of my age. First of all, I'd like to thank Lee and Jamie for inviting me to do this show and for all of you coming out on this, what looks to be not as bad a Saturday morning as what the newspaper said it was going to be, which is why I brought my Walt Disney Mickey Mouse umbrella with me, which is one of my treasured possessions. I want to, you know, the fact that we're a relatively small group, I'd like to make this a very sort of interactive discussion. I just want to say a little bit about the work, and this, as Jamie mentioned, is kind of a unique opportunity for me. The work here of these large color prints of the Iraq series, which is soon to be published by Powerhouse Books in a book called IED, The Wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. When I say soon to be published, it means as soon as I get off my ass and finish writing the essay, I've done the photographs. But juxtaposing them with this work, Hitler Moves East, which is work that I started when I was in graduate school back in 1972. And it's really been very interesting for me. Jamie mentioned a number of series that I've done dealing with issues like racism and the Holocaust. And recently I've done some series that are sort of, in a kind of lighter mood, baseball and hockey. And all of that work, you know, or most of that work involved using the large format Polaroid camera. When I first got the idea of doing something about Iraq, what sort of piqued my interest was I happened to be sort of browsing the internet, and since I have a small child, I don't do internet porn. So I'm basically just looking for toys. I came across these metal painted figures of American soldiers in Iraq, and included, you would buy these in little sets, there'd be maybe six or seven, and they included, you know, Iraqi civilians at a checkpoint, and I was sort of stunned, because normally when you find toy soldiers, there's kind of a historical reference. You know, you're looking at, say, World War II, or you're looking, you know, at Vietnam, or something that's happened sometime in the past. And to my recollection, I'd never sort of seen toys being produced as a war was being fought. One interesting sort of caveat to that is that in, say, World War II, you couldn't have afforded to use the resources to produce toys. So I became sort of fascinated, and I was talking to my good friend Gary Trudeau, who Gary and I had collaborated on Hitler Moves East. And I sent Gary an email saying, you know, you got to check out this website from this company. The company was called Figarte, and Gary emailed me back, and he said, thanks for sending this to me. I've now finished my entire Christmas gift list. So I began, and this is how I almost always work. I began by collecting things. And just, I think it was back in 2003 or 2004, a toy company named King & Country, which also did metal figures, had done a set of figures of Osama bin Laden being captured by special forces. And an accessory piece was they had a vacuform cave that the top came off of, which I, you know, I sort of wonder whatever happened to those. I can't resist buying things like that. You know, I see something and go, I don't know if I'll ever do this project, but, you know, you can't pass up Osama in his cave all hunched over being captured. And in the preface to the book, I sort of ponder the question as to whether or not the White House ordered any of these sets. But as I got more sort of involved with this, and you know, Gary and I have known each other for 37 years now. You know, whenever you start saying things like that, that's when you really begin to feel like you're moving on to another plateau in life. Just like when you go to the drugstore and you tell them you have new insurance, and they say, Medicare? And I said, well, not soon, but not quite yet. And so I talked to Gary, and, you know, he was, you know, he's done a lot with Iraq and Afghanistan in his trip, and has been very involved, particularly with wounded veterans. And he's always a great resource, because he's just a fanatic researcher. And I started showing him some pictures that I did, and he offered what turned out to be a really great suggestion, a very expensive suggestion, but a great one. He said, you really should take these photographs with a digital camera. He said, this is how people are seeing the war. And so I said, okay, can I borrow $45,000 from you? I didn't say that, but I did make an investment in a digital back and a digital camera. And it was really interesting, because learning a new technology for somebody of my advanced years, as I called it, like going back to school, is not the easiest thing. You develop a certain facility. I've been using the large format Polaroid camera for about 20-some years. All this work from Hitler Moves East was done with a 2.25 single-lens Rolly. And I kept thinking, as I was struggling with this Hasselblad camera, you know, if I'd done this with my Rolly, I could have been done by now. I wouldn't have to avoid those phone calls from the publisher saying, how's the book going? Oh, it's going great. I haven't done anything, but you know, the ideas are really percolating. But it started to, once I started getting sort of familiar with the process, it really was a tremendous way to do this work, because I'd have my little setup, my digital camera and a 24-inch iMac, and I literally could see these images as I was shooting them, which was in some ways very similar to what I would do with the Polaroid. Now, of course, Polaroids are 2024 Polaroids are $200 a shot, so I guess the digital process was probably a lot cheaper. It also gave me this flexibility to make these much larger prints. And again, you know, this was sort of just a test. I did these prints that are, I think, are about 40 by 50 inches. And I found the impact of them so strong that I decided, okay, you know, that's going to be the standard size. I'm going to make these prints. And I actually have not done any digital manipulation, which, you know, given that I do have a digital camera and I have all this digital information, would be easy to do. The only thing that I did was I was looking around to see if we had one of the night vision pieces, but when I say we created a night vision filter, I mean my assistant and Bill Wegman's assistant figured out how we could make a green filter. So I would just hit that button and suddenly I was shooting like it was nighttime. One of the great ironies is I had this, you know, digital camera, digital back, the iMac, and I was holding a $5 flashlight with a little green sort of saran wrap on it. So I had like $45,000, $5,000. But together, it worked. Which is sort of the attitude I always have with my work, is just, you know, back in the old days, I used to tape mechanics lights to shoe boxes. Those were my light stands, and I would poke holes in cardboard, and that would be the headlights for, you know, the modern romance series. And when Gary and I were doing Hitler Moves East, I discovered things like gold medal flour makes great snow. I remember once in New Haven going to this little store and buying like, I don't know, 10 or 12 pounds of gold medal flour and all these little baggies. And as I'm at the register, I'm thinking, somebody might possibly misconstrue what I'm doing with this material. But, you know, it's always sort of, for me, kind of experimenting to get the result. And this, I guess the third picture from the left there of these soldiers on a little sort of hill, one of the sort of major aesthetic elements of dealing with the war in the Eastern Front in World War II was creating the Russian steppes. And one of the reasons Gary and I chose to focus our attention on the Eastern Front was that back in the 70s, the Eastern Front really wasn't that well known. I mean, there weren't that many photographs. There was very little in terms of documentary film, in large part because all this had taken place in the Soviet Union. Their archives were locked up. And so much so that I think it was BBC did a series called The Unknown War with Burt Lancaster as a narrator, which came out in 78, which was a year after our book came out. And so we had this incredible sort of visual freedom. If we created a photograph and we said tank battle in Smolensk, most people had no visual reference. I mean, people used to ask me, well, how come you didn't do the Western Front, you know, start with D-Day? And I said, well, there were two reasons. One, everybody had visual images of that. And two, the magnitude of World War II in Europe was really the Eastern Front, where there's never been any definitive number of casualties, but they estimate somewhere between 30 and 40 million people, which would include soldiers and civilians. And it was really where the war in Europe was sort of fought and eventually won, which is not to in any way denigrate, you know, the effort of the Americans and the French and the English. But by the time D-Day happened in 44, the Russians were already, I believe, in approaching or in Poland. And 80 to 85% of the German army was on the Eastern Front. So it was, the numbers were literally, when you started reading about that front, staggering. So anyway, getting back to my little hillside there, one of the first things I tried was to take paintbrushes to make like a wheat field. So that didn't work. I think I tried something else. And finally, I was at a Caldor's. I don't even think Caldor's exists anymore in Connecticut. And in order to get to the parking lot, I had to walk through their nursery department. And I saw something called grass filler seed. And there was right next to it was potting soil. And I thought, I'm going to try this. So in my little apartment in New Haven, I had a 4 by 8 foot piece of plywood and a little section, you know, I had my Russian steps, I had the mud and the snow, and then on another table was sort of the amorphous city. And so I grew this little, had this little maybe 2 by 3 foot square of grass, which Gary used to call my miniature putting green. And much to everybody's surprise, it was incredibly successful. In fact, so successful in terms of growing the grass that I had to cut it with a pair of scissors twice a week. And I remember one of my best friends from college was at Yale, and he wanted to stay at my place over Christmas while I was out of town. I said, well, Bob, I'm happy to have you stay there, but you have to water the grass and you have to cut it twice a week. Otherwise, it goes from Russian steppe to sort of, you know, sub-Saharan jungle. And because it was indoors, the grass was kind of pale, which worked even better, made it look more like a wheat field. And all of these prints were done on a paper called Codalith, which was intended to be a black and white paper that graphic designers used, where you get letter form, so you just got black and white. But an artist named Les Krims, who was working up in Rochester, discovered that if you added some water to the developer, you got these beautiful sepia tones, which were, you controlled somewhat like you were a lithographer. It was really developing by eye. And since I never had any patience for, you know, okay, you got to let it develop for 2 minutes and then flip it over, developing by eye was just like perfect for me. I now understand why my 4-year-old son has all these habits that he has. Like, you know, I don't like that rule, Daddy. We have a new rule. I'm in charge, which he kind of is, but, you know, we like to pretend that we're in charge. So I could create this sort of almost vintage feel to the prints. And sadly, Kodak stopped making this paper in the late 70s. I sort of understood, you know, at the time I was living in Northern California, and the regional distributor for Kodak products was in South San Francisco, and I would go there and I'd buy Codalith paper. I'd buy like a case, you know, 10 or boxes at a time. And they knew me because I was the only person in the entire West Coast from Washington to San Diego buying Codalith paper. So it was not a complete shock to me when they announced that they were discontinuing the product that pretty much I was the only person buying. And Gary's comment was, well, you're going to have to find a new career, because up to that point, everything I'd been printing was on Codalith. I've now almost driven Polaroid into bankruptcy. So, you know, I think Hasselblad should be very afraid at this moment that I'm using their product. Either that or they want to give me free equipment so I can... but as I said earlier, to me, it's a really... And this is the first time I've exhibited the Iraq work. And I felt, when Lee called and we were talking about doing the show, how appropriate it was to show this work in Washington, D.C. Thank goodness we're showing it under much happier circumstances than we were a few weeks ago. But nonetheless, you know, this is an ongoing conflict. And to be able to show this work and to show, you know, this work from 30-some years ago, you know, I have to say, as I started really getting involved with this series, it brought back such an energy, you know, because I always felt that of all the bodies of work that I'd done, Hitler Museum was the most important, not just because it was the first, but because it dealt with such a significant issue, which was the idea of war. And I think it was not a coincidence that, you know, Gary and I were both college students during the Vietnam War. While we were at Yale, you know, Vietnam was still winding down. But I'll never forget, I think Life magazine was still being published as a weekly back then. They did an issue where they published the photographs of all the Americans who were killed that week in Vietnam. And it was like looking at a high school yearbook. It was kind of page after page of these little photographs. And there was no text, just, you know, the name of the person, where they were from. And you saw all these faces, men and women, you know, either like high school graduation pictures or pictures of them in their uniform. And to me, when I looked at that, it was the most singular, most powerful anti-war statement you could ever imagine. So we were doing this work in that kind of context, and, you know, we weren't trying to make an anti-war statement because not, you know, we were both, you know, 20, I think it was 25, 26 when we were doing this work. So we, to be honest, you know, we've joked about this over the years, we weren't really quite sure what we were doing, except, you know, we had this idea and we were breaking all these rules in part because we didn't even know the rules existed. And what was funny, when the book came out in 77, I remember going to V. Dalton's bookstore, so excited that, you know, my book was in the store. And it was in the history section because there was no art genre or photography genre to put it in. And it was sort of, you know, I think the book is a strong statement about war because we didn't start out saying we're going to make an anti-war statement. I think it really grew out of the time and our subconscious feelings. You know, neither of us served in the military, but, you know, the military was all around us. One of the grad students in photography had been an undergraduate at Yale, dropped out of college, gone into the Marines, and then come back, which was not uncommon. There were a number of, you know, quite a few Yale undergraduates who did that. George Bush was not one of them. But it was there, you know, and it was certainly, I remember as an undergraduate when I was at Stanford, you know, and the draft and, you know, the, I knew one person who committed suicide when he got his draft notice. I mean, it was, you know, it was a horrible period on so many different levels. And here with the war in Iraq, because we have this all-volunteer army, we're sort of anesthetized in some ways from it. And so, you know, when I, like I say, when I started doing this work, I felt a lot of the same passions that I felt looking at the Hitler Museum's work. And it, so it's been very gratifying to me, even though we're looking at, you know, almost 40 years difference. I can't say 40 because then, you know, you'd have to call the EMS or something. It's been very sort of motivating to me. And even though, you know, the book is coming out and I've finished the work for the book, it's a project that I still want to continue because we spent 3.5 years doing Hitler Museum. And I remember Gary explaining to the publisher why it took us longer to do the book than it took to fight that aspect of World War II. And I said, well, you know, we had to clean up afterwards. And there was no Marshall Plan. But I've become very, very sort of immersed and intrigued about this work. And as my skill levels have, you know, increased, I want to keep pursuing it. And sadly, I think no matter what we do, there's still going to be a war going on for some period of time to kind of explore. So with that long, rambling trip to the psychiatrist, I will open this up to questions anyone might like to ask. Oh, okay. Yeah, this is so high tech. I think only my 4-year-old could figure this out.
It's a crooner. You can sing, David.
No, I can't.
Does anybody have any questions?
I not only can't sing, I can't even sing in the shower. It's really embarrassing. Uh-huh. Yes.
Could you talk about your use of depth
of field? Oh, this is why I love questions, because since I always speak extemporaneously, I once tried giving a talk with notes. But since my corrected vision is 5/200, it was like, I said, you know, I can't do this. So I've learned to speak in this sort of extemporaneous pattern. And so as a consequence, I often forget things. Thank you, because that's like the key element of all my work. When I was doing Hitler Moves East, I discovered, you know, these figures I was initially photographing were less than an inch tall. So I was down on the floor with my single lens, 2.25 camera. And inherently, everything was out of focus except for this one little figure. And what I discovered was in looking at a lot of documentary photographs, particularly the work of Robert Capra, that lack of focus and that sense of movement gave you a sense of life. And so I could make these little figures seem much more alive with this narrow depth of field. And what I actually did was I would use like a slow shutter speed and handhold the camera. And as the book progressed, I came across these larger figures, which were actually made in exactly the same way these figures are, contemporary soldiers are. You get like a plastic kit with torsos, arms, legs, weapons, all separate. And then you would paint them and put them together, which gave you the freedom to adjust the poses. And they were much, much more detailed than the sort of, you know, the ones in the center there, that's actually the floor of my bedroom at my parents' home. You can't quite see the linoleum, pattern linoleum, very popular in the 50s. The first time I did a little fire scene, I burned this bridge. This is kind of the thinking, art student thinking. I'm burning a bridge. The fire is real. The bridge is a toy. That's sort of like Duchamp. And I tried to be a little careful. You know, I put aluminum foil underneath, you know, underneath my little water that I'd made on paper. Unfortunately, not realizing that plastic actually burns at a very high temperature, so I bubbled up a little of the linoleum. So this was all over like Christmas vacation in 72. So I went upstairs, and I have an extremely supportive family, and I'm very, very grateful that my parents are still around and my three younger siblings. So I went upstairs, and I said, "Yeah, Mom, I'm really sorry. I tried to be careful, but I, you know, bubbled up a little bit of the linoleum." My mother's response was, "I never liked that linoleum." So she was able to put in that parquet floor that she had always wanted. So it was kind of a win-win situation. But it was, I'm sorry, I'm rambling off here as I often do, but yeah, there was a lot of just sort of experimenting and discovering as I went along. And, you know, a lot of it became, particularly when Gary and I were doing the book. And the book really came about because Jim Andrews, who was Gary's publisher, the press used to be called Sheet Andrews McNeil, and they syndicated Doonesbury, and they also published some books. And they had purchased, I think it was Willard Sheed was the publisher, who actually did mostly sort of Jesuit religious philosophy books. So Hitler Museum's Fit, it's the only art book they've ever done. And when I see John McNeil, I kind of jokingly say, well, I guess you decided you didn't need to do another one after this. But Gary had done his graduate thesis on German graphics of the 30s and 40s. He created a fictional Luftwaffe pilot and did his whole biography using graphic symbols. To this day, I still don't quite understand what Gary was doing, but they saw Gary's work, and you know, he and I, since we were both looking at a lot of documentary work from World War II, and they saw my photographs, which at that point really weren't focused on Eastern or Western Front. It was just, you know, toy soldiers. And they said to us soon after graduation, why don't you two guys do a book together? We were 24 at the time, and something like, well, cool, sure, we could do a book. So we got this contract. We were supposed to deliver it in 1 year. As I said, it took us 3.5. And we got an advance. I think we each got like $900. And I remember when Gary handed me the check, and he said, now, just remember, if you cash this check, we really do have to do this book. Now, you know, in 1974, $900 was a lot of money. You could actually go buy a really good camera for $900. So there was a lot of, you know, problem solving. Like Gary would say, you know, I think we really need this kind of shot. And then I would sort of figure out, how can I do that? And I remember as we were winding down, Gary came over to my apartment one day for a sort of frenetic work session that was fueled by those little Hostess powdered sugar donuts, an insane amount of Coca-Cola, Twinkies, and it was, you know, we look back at that, and we used to get together at least once a week and go to IHOP, and every time, and then we'd go to a movie, some World War II movie, and every time we'd walk out of IHOP, and Gary, we'd always order the same thing. I'd order, like, dollar-sized pancakes and hash browns and bacon, you know, all that good stuff. I'm glad there's a doctor sitting in the front now, and Gary had some sort of IHOP special, and we walked towards the car, and Gary said, I feel awful, but we'd still order it, and then we'd go to the movies and have popcorn. So it was, you know, it was kind of like Dan Aykroyd, you know, we were two wild and crazy guys just figuring this thing out, and it's been a source of great pride and also amusement to us as we go see this work in museums. I remember once we were at the Whitney and they had a couple of pieces up and the curator was taking us around and there was a docents group and this woman was explaining about the work and, you know, we were just standing off on the side trying not to laugh because she made it sound so important. And I do remember also, we were taking the train once from New Haven into New York, and Gary was reading me the introduction that he had written. And he's going along, and it sounded wonderful. And he turned to me and he goes, well, that was what we were trying to do. And I go, I don't know, but that sounds really good. And I think, to be honest, that's sort of how I've always worked. You know, I remember once Gregory Crutzen, who's, Gregory is about 10 or 15 years younger than I am, and we were having dinner, and he said, you know, gosh, you've taken on these subjects like, you know, racism with blackface and the Holocaust. And he said, you know, I wish I had the courage to do that. And I said, Gregory, it's not courage. It's just, you know, the blackface, for example, I was having, it actually, the idea was generated here in Washington, D.C. I was doing an interview William Kristen Berry and I were being interviewed by Mary Foresta for a magazine called C that was published by the Friends of Photography, who are now no longer in existence. And Bill's probably, what, 10 years older than I am? He's originally from Alabama, and one of the great storytellers in that same vein as his good friend and mentor, Walker Evans, who was also one of my teachers at Yale. And poor Mary was actually trying to get us to focus on something. And I think it was around the time that Newt Gingrich had just sort of risen up, and we were making references to the Holocaust and Newt Gingrich and, you know, the Klan and Newt Gingrich. And somehow we got off on this tangent of talking about Birth of a Nation. And for dinner we had Chinese takeout, and Bill opened up some very, very good 20-year-old bourbon and disappeared upstairs and came back down with a copy of The Leopard Spots, which I believe was the book on which Birth of a Nation was based. And I started thinking, you know, I could do this series. You know, I've got like Civil War soldiers, I've got this and that, but I don't have anything to reference slavery. So a couple of weeks later, I went to this big collectible show in Atlantic City called Atlantique City. and it's enormous. There are like 1,500 dealers from all over the world. It's at the convention center, and you can find anything. So I was going around looking for essentially black memorabilia to be part of this Birth of a Nation series. And, you know, I knew, you know, I sort of had a superficial knowledge of black memorabilia, you know, the salt and pepper shakers and, you know, the cookie jars. But going around this incredible convention center, and, you know, there are probably 20 or 30 dealers who just specialized in black memorabilia. And I began to see the depth and enormity of it. I came back to New York with like 4 shopping bags full of stuff, went to the Polaroid studio, took a couple of photographs, and I said, you know, forget Birth of a Nation. This is so amazing. And that's sort of how, you know, my ideas come about. Now, unfortunately, I once recounted this story to somebody who was writing a newspaper piece, and they kept saying, well, can I see some of the photographs from the Birth of a Nation? I said, but that's the whole point. There were never any photographs. And, you know, we talked for a while, and, you know, we're running this piece. You know, do you think you could show us some of those early pictures? I said, well, but they don't exist. So, but that's kind of, you know, that's essentially how I work, is I find things, I think about them. You know, I've got so many toys sort of stashed away. Although I do have to admit, in the 4.5 years that our son has been around, and probably a number of months before he was born, I remember coming across this wind-up Japanese toy of a baby crawling on the floor from the 50s. And I started remembering all those great wind-up toys from when I was a kid. So I was buying a lot of these, and my wife would say, are you doing a series on these? Are these for Sam? Oh, honey, I've got this idea. You know, so there's like boxes of stuff. And I did actually go back to a theme that I had done very, very briefly for a show at Cal State Long Beach back in, I think it was 88. They would do these shows where they asked artists to do new work. And I remember the curator called me up and said, well, do you have any projects that you haven't started yet but you're thinking about? I said, yeah, I've got these two ideas. One is sort of space toys, and the other is sex toys. And she goes, literally, I can't say it fast enough. Space toys would be just perfect for us. And, you know, I shot maybe 20 or 30 images on the Polaroid camera, and I just started working on the camera at that time. And I don't know, I think it was just, maybe it was Sam's interest in outer space, but I started, and I had a lot of space toys, and so I got this idea, maybe I'll go back and do space toys. This was at, towards the end of 2007. So, you know, and probably also subconsciously to just say to my wife, see, I really am doing a series on these. So Sam and I would go to the Polaroid studio, and, you know, he'd be taking out these toys and playing with them, and I'd be photographing them. And of course, being the, you know, my wife is always the, she's the bad cop, and I'm like, I'm not even the good cop. I'm not even a cop at all. I'm more like a co-conspirator. You know, and Sam would say, could I play with one of your vintage toys, Daddy? Like that one that's in the box? I go, oh, sure. Let's open up and take it out. And he's playing with some rocket ship from, you know, early 50s. And my wife says, well, is that an expensive toy? And I said, well, relative to what? You know, because space toys are highly collectible and really expensive. Like robots can go for, you know, $15,000. So I said, no, it's not really that expensive. Being a good wife and mother, she said, well, how much is it? $690. And, you know, he's running around on the floor with it. I said, but, you know, really, relative to the other toys I'm photographing, it's not that expensive. So he said, okay. You know, but. So he got to pick out one space toy that he could take care of for Daddy for this project. So it's now somewhere in his room.
Seem to be seen soon.
Yeah. You know, and I should point out, my wife is a cake decorator and designer, so he's growing up with surrounded by cakes and toys. And when before he started going to preschool, I sort of had the feeling he'd just say, you know, I don't really want to go to school, Dad. I just kind of want to stay home. You know, and to which I would have said, Sam, I'd love it if you want to stay home and play with me all day, because nothing in the world makes me happier. So on that note, I think I answered your question for about 20 minutes. Well, thank you all again. It actually looks sunny out today. Thank you all again. I'm old, so I'm just going to keep sitting here.
Good.
Oh, we're still on air.
We're still on air.